Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I'm Patrick, and I'm here today with my friends Chris.
Hello.
And Steven.
Hi.
And we are here today to discuss Ty West's X, which we kind of narrowly missed when we were going through the A24 catalog a few months ago in solidarity with the writers and actors strikes in Hollywood. But now it's very recently arrived on Netflix, so we'll be talking about it today. But before we get into that, we always start off the show with a little bit of horror catch-up. What have you guys been reading or watching or experiencing in the horror world since last we met?
I've been watching True Detective Night Country. I've just been calling it Night Country on HBO, and it's okay. I don't know. It's really starting to lose me. I mean, I'm glad there's only two more episodes left, but I texted Patrick after the most recent episode. Like, the cracks are starting to show for me, and it's starting to feel a little too Flanagan-y for me. Like, I'm not getting that sense of dread that I got from the first season that I was hoping this season would sort of bring back to the series. Nevertheless, I'm excited to see how the mystery unfolds, and I hope we get some satisfying answers. What have you been up to, Patrick?
Also been watching Night Country, kind of more with half an eye on it, because I've been creating some horror lately. Folks on the Discord got a little preview of this. I am making my first comic, and it's going to be a horror short story, so more to come on that.
Nice.
If you want to look at it, go join our Discord. There's a link in the show notes, and there's lots of other wonderful stuff to check out on there besides my artwork. Outside of that, also been playing Control, the sort of sequel to Alan Wake, which I enjoyed quite recently. Loving the vibes of that one. It's just super spooky, unsettling, chilly, sci-fi, horror, conspiracy theory kind of shit. I have no idea really what the fuck is going on, and I'm loving the surrealism of it all thus far. And then the final note I'll throw in is I just checked out a new horror comic called Somna, S-O-M-N-A, by Becky Cloonan, who is a creator who I've really admired for a long time. And let me get this name right. Tula Lote, who was new to me, they're kind of jamming on this comic. They're swapping off art duties on this story about a woman who lives in a village around the time of witch hunts and is being visited by a kind of demon in her sleep who is indulging her sexual fantasies. And I don't know, I'm very interested to see where it's going from here. The art is fucking gorgeous, and the first chapter was really compelling, so I'm excited to read the rest of that. And other than that, I've been watching X, my pick. I watched it in the theater when it came out, I think probably opening weekend. Steven, I think you saw it right around the same time, right?
Yeah, I saw it at Cinema Detroit with my good friend, or I guess our friend Alexandra, and we had a fucking blast with it. That's a really good movie to see with a crowd.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
I had never seen it before, and I wouldn't say that I've been avoiding it. I don't know, it didn't really grab my attention at the time it came out. And then, I don't know, I think the contrarian elements in me, the more I heard from the horror people about how good this was, and they wouldn't shut the fuck up about it, and they wouldn't shut the fuck up about Pearl, I kind of just was like, well, I'll get to that when I get to it, damn it. You can't peer pressure me.
It's kind of like me with Radiohead.
Yeah,
back in high school.
And then I not just peer pressured, but like peer forced you into watching it for the show.
Yeah, it's kind of like how I feel about Everything Everywhere All at Once. Like, I'm sure that's a great movie, but I kind of don't want to watch it just because the fans annoy me so much.
It's so fucking
good. You're going to like it as much as I did. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's incredible. I love that movie.
But I mean, you two are fans of this movie, right? I mean, I don't think there's any sense in playing our cards close to the chest on reviews here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we even made that clear last episode. But yeah, we're fans. It was interesting for me because I definitely liked it when I saw it the first time. I was not maybe a love on it. And then Pearl blew my fucking mind, as I've raved about on this show a million times before.
We'll get into that because I am curious about Pearl. But
yes,
we're here to talk about
We'll talk about Pearl, and we'll also talk about Maxine a little bit at some point, too, at least what we know. But yeah, we should stick to X for now.
Well, now that we've set the agenda, X is the story of a group of hot young 20-somethings who are in a fucking van in 1979, driving through, is it Louisiana, I think?
Texas.
Texas, sorry.
And sure,
deep in the heart
of Texas. And sure, we've seen this story before.
Oh, yeah. Big Texas Chainsaw vibes and big, you know, gnarly late 70s, early 80s slasher vibes in general. But these folks are out to make a porn film. They have made arrangements to stay in a cabin on a remote farm property to shoot this film. The old people who own the property are not necessarily aware that this is what these kids are doing. And killings ensue from there.
And we know that killings will ensue because the opening scene of this movie shows you the aftermath of the events of the movie. So you see the police arrive on the scene and you see all the bodies, but you don't see who's there. And it whets your appetite that something gnarly is going to happen. And I think not only is that sort of an interesting scene into itself, but it, I think, does a lot to keep you from getting bored during the first hour of this movie, which is like a hangout movie. It's pretty slow.
Yeah.
And there's pressure because we know this happened just 24 hours ago. We see the aftermath and then it flashes to just 24 hours ago. So this did not take long to happen.
Which I love that. I like, don't give me 20 years ago. No. Don't give me 18 days ago. 24 hours ago. The shorter, you know, it's like Aristotle said, the tighter your time frame, the better your film. That's why Nick of Time is the best movie.
Give me 24 hours ago or 28 days later.
Yeah.
I don't need 28 weeks. I don't need 28 years, which apparently we're getting at some point.
Yeah. I knew a 28 days later joke was sneaking in there at some point.
And yeah, I was... despite all my, I'm not going to say skepticism because I didn't really doubt that this movie was going to be at least fine, but all my cynicism that I may have brought into this viewing experience with me disappeared with the first shot of the movie, which is like the best shot of a movie I've seen in a while. And it was so refreshing. I was like, especially because like I said, I like the cinematography and look away, and I did, but there's a difference I think between having aesthetically pleasing cinematography that looks good and cinematography that's like elevating the material and telling the story and communicating things. And so the first shot is like, it's almost framed like 4:3, but we're looking through the door of the rental house and we
door
see
of the barn.
We see the farmhouse where the old couple live and we see a cop car pull up to it. Oh, what's going to happen? Then we push forward through the door, like the Searchers, and the panorama opens up. And I'm sure it was a search, like a deliberate Searchers reference. There's no way you can do that without thinking about the Searchers.
Yeah.
And you see that there's like five cop cars here, and we are well in the middle of some aftermath here, and it kind of goes from there. But I thought that shot was so interesting and communicated so much in such a cool way that I said, okay, I remember why I liked Ty West all those years ago. We are in the hands of a master filmmaker.
Yeah, and we have a kind of cast of some current horror luminaries in this movie, too. I mean, I this movie certainly made me a goth between this and Pearl. This was the first thing I ever saw her in, anyways. And I had completely forgotten because, I mean, as you and I were texting last night, Steven, I didn't even know who this was at the time, but fucking Jenna Ortega is in this as well. And then
best known from the Wednesday Dance.
Yeah. And then also Brittany Snow, who is in, I don't know, a bunch of stuff that I've seen.
Would you rather?
Oh, she, yeah, right. Damn.
Whoa, yeah, we've got Kid, is it Cudi or Cootie?
Kid Cudi, oh yeah, that's right, yep.
Kid Cudi's in it, and also one of the kids from Super Dark Times is in this, which I think I might have seen that movie after this. Great cast across the board. Really talented, charismatic actors.
And we've got Mia, of course, in a double role as both our protagonist, Maxine, and the, I guess, antagonist, anti-hero of the thing, Pearl, in heavy, heavy aging makeup, which I, you know, whatever, I'm faced.
Wait.
What?
I thought for sure it was Mark Rylance.
I thought it was, oh shit, I can't land my joke.
Gary Oldman?
No.
She is serving some like Mason Verger vibes in this. I wouldn't be surprised.
I thought it was Rory Kinnear.
Fuck, that's who I was thinking of when I said Mark Rylance. God damn it. I blew my own joke.
Oh, damn it.
But yeah, I'm face blind or whatever, but like when I first saw this, I did not. I kept looking at her and going, that old woman looks kind of weird. Something seems off about her. And then finally at the end, I was like, oh, that was the same girl? What the fuck? So it was nice to watch it this time and actually like be aware of that, the dual performance while watching it.
Yeah, it could not be clearer that with both members of this couple, that these are clearly people in outrageous makeup. Mm-hmm. I mean, even like, even her movements specifically just look so like comically exaggerated at times that probably took me half the movie to figure out that it was at least one of the cast members, if not Mia Goth.
They're moving like Henry Selick characters.
A little bit. Stop motion
vibes. I clocked pretty early on that we're dealing with a young woman playing an old woman, but I didn't figure out until the last, I don't know, 20 minutes of the movie that was Mia Goth in a double role. And that was interesting. And I forget what happened to give it, but like, you know, it's like Mia Goth isn't someone who I'm super familiar with her face. I have seen her before. I did watch Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Volume 1.
Oh shit, she was in that? Wow.
I did not watch Volume 2, which is my review. But I had seen her before. But I, you know, it's not like a face that, it's not a face like Johnny Depp that you recognize no matter what, right? So, I didn't recognize it until like later she said something and her mannerism was like, oh wait, this person seems familiar to me. But I don't know, that's fun. That's all fun.
Yeah.
And it makes sense why they're able to make a prequel.
Yeah. Which I wonder if that was already the plan when they made this or if it was just like, sure, let's do a weird stunt and have Mia play the old woman, too.
Well, I do have some background on this, but it may be incomplete. So they shot this in New Zealand.
And they got quarantined, right?
They got quarantined. I think in New Zealand, the quarantine time was a month. Mm-hmm. So they had A24 had agreed to fund this. During that month, Ty West and Mia Goth wrote Pearl. But they didn't go to New Zealand planning for this to be anything other than...
Right.
One film. So it makes me wonder, especially having seen Pearl and now having seen X, I think, three times, there were little touches here and there that I think might have been added since they knew that they had secured that A24 was just going to greenlight Pearl no matter what. Because when this came out in theaters, it premiered, you know, in its, you know, limited release with the Pearl trailer at the end.
Right? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was already in the bag.
That's cool.
Which was a delightful WTF moment because... Yeah, that was the announcement that Pearl was even happening. It was like, wait, what the fuck? There's going to be a prequel to this strange-ass movie?
That's really cool.
Yeah, and it looks like a total... You know, at the time, I'm thinking, oh my god, it looks like a totally different style, too.
Yeah.
It's like the Wizard of Oz. Yeah. Like, what is happening? Just what a wonderful surprise.
Yeah.
Well, there's also like a lot of parallels that they show you between the old woman and Maxine, our Mia Goth character. And that's sort of where some of the tension comes in the movie because the old woman is like, oh, you're so beautiful. I used to be just like you. Now I'm decrepit. Now nobody wants me. And that's kind of the conflict behind the whole movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how much we want to get into at this point, but you know that
I mean, this movie, if the title hadn't already been taken, it should have been called Old.
No, I mean, Pearl is one of the most compelling and sympathetic slashers
Wow.
of No. I will disagree. Oh, interesting.
Oh, okay. In the movie Pearl, yes. In this movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. So I guess I'm operating somewhat with the context I have from watching Pearl. Okay. But I mean,
you called Pearl an anti-hero a few minutes ago, and I was like, not in this movie.
I don't know. I think even in this one, I think even when I saw it without having the context of Pearl, I mean, you know, whatever. Obviously, this is a deeply unstable woman doing fucked up things, like invading people's homes and fucking killing people and whatever. But she wants to be loved. She wants to be touched. She wants to be appreciated. And the world has denied her that, which is really fucking sad. She wants the
same things as all of us. Yeah, it is sad.
Yeah, yeah.
It is deeply sad. I wouldn't say I necessarily sympathize with her on any level, except that her sense of longing is very sad. And that it's so strong that she goes to the lengths that she does, which are, of course, despicable and reprehensible and unwarranted and unrelatable.
She's certainly way more sympathetic than, say, the cast of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which this movie is so clearly inspired by.
Yeah.
You mean like Leatherface?
Yeah, or like, you know, whatever their whole deal
was. Or fucking Jason, or like any of these slasher type movies.
Like, there's some work to humanize her, but I think vitally it doesn't go too far into, like, I don't think, she's not, like Steven said, it's, you can't let her off the hook for what she does. It's just an interesting motivation for a slasher.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like everybody wants to fuck, but nobody should kill because nobody wants to fuck.
Oh, of course not. That wasn't my implication. I just mean her basic motivation is very relatable. And it's like, I don't know. I feel like it's rare that we even get like an exploration of particularly an older woman's sexuality, like that we dig into an older woman's sexuality whatsoever in a movie.
Or even an older man's, you know.
Sure.
We deal with both of their sexualities. And that is interesting. There's a scene later on that we can talk about in the spoiler room that I found even more interesting on this viewing, where she does have a basic desire simply to be seen, but she crosses the line basically sexually assaulting a young man is her first victim. Like, it starts off as something seemingly innocent, and the young man's response I found very interesting, because I don't know that he could have gotten off the hook necessarily, but just his sheer revulsion at her before she even is even within 10 feet of him is sad, you know. We don't treat elders in our country the way they do in some other cultures, like in Japan. A lot of people tend to find them even just disgusting to look at. Their problem we want to sweep under the rug. And this movie deals with that in, I think, a surprisingly delicate way that doesn't hit you over the head.
And a particularly devastating way by the end. Like, I mean, we're going to get into that in the spoiler room, but I mean, the ending is fucking sad, and I think this actually has some serious shit to say about women and how we treat them in general, particularly as they age.
I thought that one scene was interesting because the revulsion is totally relatable. I'd be probably repulsed too in those circumstances, but it's also very, you sympathize with the woman a lot too. So it's like it was kind of interesting to like feel both sides of that in one scene.
Right. Especially because like, I think it's fairly easy to infer that this is not the first time that's happened to her. Like, this woman would not be so like touch starved in the first place if she hadn't been shunned by various people in various ways for many, 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 many years.
What I find an interesting layer on top of that, though, and this movie is very layered in so many fascinating ways. I mean, let's talk about this old age makeup again for a second, because they just like Pearl looks like outrageously old. And this is clearly an intentional choice on the filmmaker's part, but you know, I have a lot of friends who are in their 70s and even 80s, and they look great.
You're not repulsed by their touch.
Oh,
I'm not repulsed by their touch at all.
Pearl takes place in 1918. This is 61 years later.
She does show her wedding photo, right, and say that was before the first war.
In Pearl. We should remember that, because he's in World War One in Pearl.
Well, and that is our clue, if you hadn't figured it out by that point, that it's Mia Goth playing Pearl.
I didn't recognize her in the photo.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just.
Now, granted, I have seen it a few times at this point, so I don't know if I clocked that the first time or not, but clever detail.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've actually heard criticism from some people saying that the horror genre and this movie in particular are ableist, ageist, etc. And I watched this movie trying to have that take, and I can't go there with this one, because I think even though the old age, first of all, I might get canceled for this. I don't think it's that bad to like stigmatize getting old and dying. I feel like that's kind of a universal human anxiety. Certainly no reflection on old people, but like, you know, the contrast between sickness and health and youth and age and everything like that are cosmic themes. And I don't think that it's wrong to be afraid of being old or feeble or dead when you're young, as long as you're treating people who are old and feeble and dead well. So
absolutely.
But anyway, so I was kind of looking for this, like, all right, is this, and I can totally see how someone could be like, well, it's not appropriate to just have your monster be a ridiculously old person that you might look like someday. But also, you know, I think it did have some nuanced things to say about aging that were humanizing. So I can't convict anybody. I can see how someone could say it's in poor taste, but I don't think this movie is your problem.
Well, and I think he's also kind of tweaking a certain genre or subgenre here, too, because there are a lot of, I don't know, I'm actually kind of blanking on a good example right now, but there's a lot of just, like, scary old lady horror movies, right?
Yeah. It's not like Shutter Island where or something. Where it's like you go to the asylum and everybody's just old.
Yeah.
Or like The Visit.
Yeah.
The Night Shyamalan movie.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, you know, whatever. This is still, like, not going to win a fucking, like, AARP award or something for, like, representation of elders. But still, I think it brings a lot more depth and empathy to that just concept of, it's a scary old lady, you know?
Well, and hey, like, how often do you get to see people who are, like, in their late 80s, early 90s fucking on screen, you know?
Yeah.
I think it should get an award for representation.
Yeah. Well, and especially, you know, and I guess, I think, again, probably this is maybe better discussed in the spoiler room, but I think the really interesting thing is how it kind of draws attention to that there's not that much difference. There's not really all that much that separates the desperate place that Pearl is in and the perhaps self-deludedly hopeful place that Maxine is in. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we're not so different, you and I.
Yeah, the stunt casting is a little bit more than just stunt casting there.
Oh, yeah.
And it definitely does say, you know, hey, you can think this is gross and scary, but it could be you someday. Think about that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the movie that they're making and the cast. There's a scene I really liked at the beginning where they stop at a gas station and there's some character development. But the part I really liked was they start shooting a scene of the movie while they're getting gas, and it's their lead actor, Kid Cudi. Is that how we pronounce him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kid Cudi is pumping gas, and Brittany Murphy's character we should probably just say who the six characters are. We got Kid Cudi, who's like sort of your typical porn star male. He's a Vietnam veteran. We got Mia Goth. She is a stripper who works for, I don't know the guy's name, the Kurt Russell like fellow.
The poor man's Matthew McConaughey.
Poor man's McConaughey.
Martin Henderson. Also, you said Brittany Murphy. It's Brittany Snow.
that would be a scary movie. That would be a scary movie. So we have the poor man's Matthew McConaughey, who is the owner, I think, of this strip club, basically in Houston. And so he has Mia Goth, who is his fiance and one of his dancers. There's Brittany Snow, who is another one of his dancers, and it's sort of like the stereotypical what you think of when you think of a porn star sort of person. Then there's Kid Cudi. Then there is the cinematographer, who's this like
Owen Campbell.
He's like this nerdy kid who doesn't seem to fit in with the others, but he's there to make his movie. And then there's his girlfriend, Jenna Ortega, she goes by Church Mouse for a lot of this movie because she's very mousy and she wears a cross and she's prudish. And so those are your characters. Anyway, they stop for gas and Brittany Snow's character, who you would expect to be in stereotype, like, you know, the ditzy, whatever, the hot chick, says, "You should shoot this shot from above so it looks like he's filling up the car with his cock."
Yeah, she's like, shoot it from above and pan down, and it's a much better, more interesting shot. And the cinematographer is delighted because he's basically told us at this point he's trying to make this seem like an art film.
Yes.
So that it will be taken more seriously.
He wants to use the art of montage.
What's the line that he says? He says something about dirty movies.
I don't recall.
He says something like, "I want to prove that a dirty movie can be good," or something like that. Hmm. Or that a good movie can be dirty. Something like that. And that really stood out to me because I was like, I feel like that's what Ty West is doing here. Because
he is. Absolutely.
This is, in terms of formula, this is like a terrible slasher movie that we've seen 100 times, but this time it's good. He might be trying to make it too good. We'll talk about that. But anyway, I thought that was really cool. And I also liked how, you know, there's a lot of movies I've seen that are like meditations on filmmaking and the process of making a film. Christopher Nolan is always doing this. All his movies are about the art of making a movie, Inception especially. But like when you watch a Christopher Nolan movie, it's very like, well, everything flows from the auteur and here's how he crafts his thing. And what I liked about this shot and the scene is it's showing the collaborative side of filmmaking and how someone you wouldn't expect who is involved in your movie will just have an idea and just really contribute. And I feel like I haven't seen that a lot in any of these other movies that are like about filmmaking, and it's true to my limited experience with filmmaking. And it also plays Brittany Snow's character against type and shows you that, you know, she has some depth, and all these characters have a bit of depth, except for maybe the poor man's McConaughey, but
so that's at the gas station. We get to the cabin. Everybody's very excited to make this movie. Everybody's very horny at this point because they haven't fucked in like however many hours it took them to drive to this part of Texas.
2 hours.
they see the gruesome old man, Pearl's husband, leave the property. It's time to get down to it, and very quickly sexual tensions flare. Right, like we've got Brittany Snow and her sort of boyfriend. You know, they shoot a scene that I think the poor man's Kurt Russell says, you know, something to the tune of, when people see this, their eyes are gonna pop out of their head.
Yeah,
and that gets a great payoff later.
Wow,
it's also a great payoff to the comment about the art of montage too. The way that moment is cut. But yeah, for the next like 45 minutes or so, it's these characters sort of shooting the movie, trying less and less to be discreet about it, catching glimpses of the host family and getting sort of creeped out by them. It's really a hang, though. We spend time getting to know these characters. There's a great scene where they're jamming to Landslide.
Yeah.
And they do talk about their feelings about jealousy and sexuality and aging. It's the only time in this movie where it really, like, straight up tells you that it has themes that are being Trojan horsed into what is otherwise, like Chris said, a boilerplate slasher formula. And I thought the way that was done was really tasteful as well.
Yeah, it is interesting the pace at which this all plays out. Because, you know, as Chris was saying, like, you know, this might not have such a sense of urgency if you didn't already know from the opening scene that, you know, all these killings are going to happen. But it is compelling and funny and, you know, perverted and kind of sexy at times. And there's a lot of entertainment value to string you along until the killings begin. You know, there is character development, and these people feel like real people, even though they're kind of sleaze bags a lot of the time. I don't know. It's a compelling and pretty, like, it flies by. It's an hour that flies by, even though there's not a whole hell of a lot happening.
I will say it pushed the limit of my patience. I was starting to get antsy towards the end of the hangout section. I was starting to feel how slow the movie was at that point. But then I said, you know what? Like, this is what Ty West has been doing. This is like the two movies he made, The Innkeepers and The House of the Devil, that are the only ones by him that I've seen other than Cabin Fever 2. And
wow, I forgot he did that.
And liked so much. I've liked because they've had those long hangout vibes and like the mumblecore stuff, and people are just hanging out. I saw a review that was like, yeah, Ty West again affirms his commitment to movies where absolutely fucking nothing happens or something. And I was like, yeah, it works though.
Yeah.
And it works especially in this one, I think, because the characters are so fully realized.
And of course, there's a near miss with the pearligator, the alligator, to spice things up. That's a great scene.
We've got, you know, Chekhov's gun, Chekhov's gator.
And I'm here for Chekhov. You know, if this is so obviously an homage to Texas Chainsaw Massacre in so many ways, but with the gator, I think it's also a sly. I would hope. I'm going to have to confirm this, but I think it might also be an homage to Toby Hooper's follow-up, Eaten Alive, which is about a family that runs a little bed and breakfast and feeds the guests to a gator.
It would have to be. Yeah,
it would have to be, right? But nobody talks about that movie, so I don't know.
I think
that sounds amazing. Is that movie good?
It's trash, but it's you have to see
that
it.
Sounds great.
It's like it's a psychedelic experience. Okay.
I'm down.
We'll have a movie night.
Yeah. Soon. But yeah, I mean, I feel like we've covered a lot of the bases before we start talking about killings and deeper themes and third act developments. Do we have anything else to talk about before we go to the spoiler alligator pond?
Let's review it. I guess I'm the only mystery here, right?
Yeah, I mean, but I'll give you Steven all. Steven and I already did.
Well, I already said. View,
well, y'all can say your piece anyway. Patrick, would you view it, cue it, or screw it?
I mean, it's a view it. I'm really not even going to add anything else. I think the past 40 minutes or however long speak for themselves. Steven, do you wish to add to your view it?
I'll add a little bit to it. Yeah, it's a high view it for me. Again, I've seen it 3 times, and I will see it at least 3 more times in my lifetime. It's just such a blast, and I find, you know, this time around, the sumptuousness of the period setting really struck me more than it had on the first 2 viewings. Like, there's never a moment where I don't feel like, again, wasn't alive to see it, but there was never a moment where I didn't feel like I was in Texas in the late 70s. I could smell this movie. I could feel the heat. It's just, for me, in a fucked up way, it's a really fun environment for me to spend an hour and 45 minutes in a film, given what a huge fan I am of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah, and I still, even though I'd seen it before, I found the kills just as satisfying as when I saw them in the theater. I mean, there are a couple of moments in this where I guffawed. Yeah. I, you know, made a sound of shocked surprise. Uh-huh. There's one in particular we'll get to in the spoiler room where I forgot that there's kind of a coda to the kill that comes a couple of minutes later that's just wonderfully outrageous and gnarly. Chris, solve the mystery for us. View it, cure it, screw it.
I will give it a view it, but it's not a huge, very high view it like you guys give it. It's a very low view it, but it's still a view it. I remember, I think a long time ago, Steven said that X is like, I think he said it's the only good sequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that. Maybe, I don't know, does that sound like something you said?
It sounds like something I would say.
Yeah. And looking at this through that lens, I can appreciate quite a bit, because any of the stuff that I was unsure of how to feel about, I'm like, well, it's basically doing what the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is doing. And I do adore that movie. So lots worked for me. I've already talked about some of it. I'll continue to talk about what worked for me. What didn't work for me is, like I said, it's a little bit slow, and also it seems to have 1 foot sort of awkwardly placed in the elevated horror category, where it seems to be trying to be a little pensive or maybe a little topical or thematic or something in sort of a forced or too serious way. And then there's also moments of slapstick comedy, some of which seem to betray the universe of the film that we are watching. And so I thought some of that was uneven. and I guess we'll talk more about that. But
I agree with that, actually, and it occurred to me both times. I think it just sat easier with me the second time because I was like, I can simultaneously like see that kind of tension, uncomfortable tension between those two things, but also I enjoy both of them so much. Like, they're both so much in my wheelhouse that I don't care, because it's just a package that appeals to me as a person, even if it may not be the best balanced mixture of elements as a film.
Are you saying this film is tonally inconsistent, Chris?
I was trying to avoid that language, because the problem isn't that it's tonally inconsistent. I just think that it's the way it shifts gears is jarring. And I mean, I look at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is very grim, very serious for the most part, very dark, and also laugh out loud funny in several moments, but you're laughing sort of at how fucked up it is. And this has some of that, and then it's like, what if we just put in a dick joke or something? But then we're immediately back to like something that's like Black Coat's daughter, like A24, like haunted house stuff. I don't know. It was a little awkward, but I mean, I feel like I'm picking nits a little bit. I'm just trying to explain why I wasn't completely engaged in some of the stuff and why I didn't leave that movie saying, oh, it's a perfect film, everybody should see it. I think it's a good film, and certainly I don't like slashers. Okay, I don't like slashers.
I don't either, really, generally.
So,
with a few exceptions.
So the fact that I like this as much as I did, and I have already recommended it to people in my life, I think shows that it's a damn good film.
All right, well, view it with lengthy with footnote caveats. Recorded with caveats recorded. And before we go to the spoiler alligator pond, we'll remind you, as always, to go to our social media at Amoncast, EHMONcast, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or I guess they call it X now. Also, go to your podcast provider of choice and leave us a review. It helps folks find the show, and we also love to see the feedback. And lastly, go to our notoriously broken website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com. I don't even know what functions on there anymore, but the merch store link sure does, and you can send a paltry amount of dollars, but still a couple dollars our way to buy a t-shirt or other merchandise with Every Horror Movie on Netflix art on it. And lastly, plugged it already, but I'll give it one more plug. Go to the show notes and check out our Discord community online. We've got folks all over the world there talking about horror movies and books. You can join Steven's Horror Book Club. You can talk about the new episode of Amon. You can talk about all kinds of shit, as long as it pertains to horror in some ways. That's again,
I'll give you free life advice.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm not a qualified professional, but if you want life advice, problems with your marriage, problems at work.
We got Steven's, Steven's book club. We'll start a Steven's Better Help channel.
Yeah. I'll try not to make your life worse for you.
All right. You guys ready to strip down and go for a swim in the spoiler alligator pond?
Of course.
Hell yeah.
All right, let's do it. Welcome back. We are splashing around here in the spoiler alligator pond, and it's time to spoil everything about X. So what do you guys think? Should we just like kind of start by like running down the kills? Who does what to whom? And
we
how?
Have eight dead bodies.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is there's a fun little subversion of a classic slasher trope here where the character who doesn't fuck gets killed first. The cinematographer.
Oh, interesting.
I didn't pick up on that until this third viewing, and I was like, oh, that's kind of clever. It's not the person you'd expect, but it sort of makes sense in the context of this movie. So Jenna Ortega has decided that she's suddenly sexually liberated and she wants to be in the movie because the cinematographer and the director, they say that what happens while they're shooting isn't real. When these people are having sex, it doesn't mean that it's that they love each other or anything. It's for the cinema.
That's a great scene.
It's a fantasy.
That's like the best scene in the movie.
Yeah.
because they have like a round table where Jenna Ortega is the church going shy girl is like,
yeah,
very skeptical of this whole making porn thing and interrogating them about how they're doing this with their boyfriends watching, etc. And it gradually evolves into her being like, it sounds kind of fun.
Let me in there.
And he gets jealous. We see him crying in the shower. He decides he's just gonna get out of there. He's gonna get in the plowing service van and leave.
This
and,
is what happens when you use non-union crew.
The whole strike could have been. And he has an encounter with Pearl. She's standing in the way of the van. He gets out. She makes a sexual advance on him, and he turns her down, and she fucking kills him. She stabs him right in the throat.
Honestly, a horrifying stabbing scene. Like, something again, the Henry Selick, like, herky-jerky motions with which she just kind of dispassionately, like, keeps stabbing and stabbing, and you, like, see his fucking, like, larynx exposed, and it's disgusting. And then, of course, we have the nice touch of blood getting spattered all over the van headlights.
And of course, the lighting
turns red for, like, diegetic reasons. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, again, I'm not a big fan of slashers. I don't usually get a lot of, like, joy out of seeing people get slaughtered on screen. And I liked this character. I like all of these characters. I like all these people, even with their flaws. So it is upsetting to see any of them get murdered. But there is a certain glee and catharsis that comes with after you've spent almost an hour watching these people, knowing they're going to die before sunrise. It finally happens, and Ty West does not hold back.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite oddly thrilling to see this series of death sequences.
The deaths in slasher movies don't bother me. I don't like slashers because I get so bored with the interstitial stuff. And this movie did a good job of not being boring in between the kills, although you still have a little bit of the, you know, we're walking around in a dark room sort of thing at sometimes. But
the poor man's Matthew McConaughey goes out to the barn in his undies. He steps on a fucking nail, and then Pearl stabs him right in the eyes with a pitchfork, which is the throwback to "This is going to make your eyes pop out of your head."
And it's the throwback to the art of montage thing, because we see, so he's crawling on the ground. He thinks that the Owen Campbell character is in the barn. He thinks he's just having a breakdown. I'm going to go give him a pep talk in the morning. We're going to keep, you know, shooting sex scenes. And he steps on the nail. He's calling out for his friend. And then he sees through these three holes in the back of the barn that a figure is moving on the other side. So, of course, what does he do? He puts his eyes up to two of the holes to look out, gets pitchforked in the eyeballs. We cut to another scene, but then a couple minutes later, we cut back to the pitchfork being pulled out of his eyes.
Yeah.
Like, the death scene isn't over, and I loved it. I kind of want to analyze that couple of minutes of film, because I didn't remember that that's how it unfolded before I rewatched it this time, and I'm curious to see if there's any reasoning for the separation of those two moments, other than just the fact that it's cool as hell and surprising.
And then Pearl just, like, calmly, like, pitchforks some hay over him to cover up the body. Yeah. That's a nice touch, too. So then the old dude comes to the farmhouse to, under the pretense of asking for help, finding his wife. At which point we get the dick joke that I think Chris referenced earlier, because the star of the porn movie is just standing in the doorway of the farmhouse butt naked, and his silhouette, you see from the farmer's point of view, just a gigantic cock hanging between his legs, and it's
comically large, swinging. It's a South Park joke.
Yeah.
I struggled with that a little bit this time. I mean, I'm not gonna get all PC, but this character does happen to be black.
Yeah.
Did they have to give him an outrageously oversized penis?
It's stupid. But it works because
yeah,
I thought of Eli Roth a lot
watching this.
Yeah, this is like if Eli Roth had taste and intelligence. But
well, not this specific moment, but the movie overall, yes.
There's some interesting tension between these two characters, though, because I mean, one, our leading man is black, and we're clearly dealing with a redneck, for lack of a better term, in Pearl's husband. But also, they've both served in the military, so we think, like, oh, maybe they can bond over that, and everything will be just okay enough that things won't escalate the way they do. But, of course, I think we're supposed to read that the husband is jealous of this man's prowess, and that only makes him further enraged.
True. Actually, I guess maybe they are trying to do something quasi-thematic there, because, of course, one of the big sources of tension between Pearl and whatever her husband's name is, you know, she wants him to fuck her, and he says he can't. He doesn't have the stamina. His heart will give out if he attempts to.
Yeah, but you did.
It's not smart.
You don't
it's
need
not
that,
smart,
though,
not smart,
because we already have that. You don't need the sight gag with the dick to get that, because that's what the whole movie's about. And he says explicitly in various moments, he's like, I'm sick of you bohemians coming over here and turning on my wife.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it's a ridiculous and unnecessary moment, but fortunately it passes quickly.
So, I don't know. I guess, I mean, that's the main moment I'm thinking of, and there's something else I can't remember that I just thought was a little bit too funny and a little bit too South Park-ish. I mean, but here's a joke I liked that was also pretty over the top, is when they're done shooting the first sex scene and Brittany Snow's character wipes herself off and throws the rag Jenna Ortega.
So gross. Like, I didn't read that as a joke, though. Like, that's just a to me, that was just an indicator of them bullying the what they perceive as the prude.
I thought it was very funny.
Oh, really?
I laughed, too. I thought it was funny, and also, like, how often do you see semen on screen? Like, I do think it was meant to be a joke.
It was funny, but it was also like I think all movies should be funny. All right, so I'm not saying a horror movie or anything can't be funny, but I think the humor has to come from the circumstances and the characters rather than like South Park sight gag that defies the laws of physics or whatever.
That guy gets dispatched very swiftly. The old guy just lures him out to the fucking alligator pond and just shotgun blasts him right in the fucking chest at point blank range.
Which is great, because you're not, I even though I'd seen this before, I expected him to die by alligator, but he gets shot.
Yeah. The alligator killing is still to come.
He also sees someone else's car has been disposed of in the swamp.
Yeah.
Because they've done this before. And around the same time, Jenna Ortega has been imprisoned in the basement and sees a corpse who I thought was the corpse of the cinematographer, but it's not, because he's still in the driveway.
I thought that at first, too. Yeah.
It's someone else that they've killed from another group of kids that's chained up in the basement with his pants down. Possibly being used as a sexual item by Pearl, perhaps.
Yeah, we see a pretty decent sized penis there too. Mm-hmm. This movie really doesn't hold back in that department. That's interesting. I assumed it was the cinematographer too, but
I did until the point at the end of the movie where you see he's still out in the driveway.
Mm. Yeah. And that leads to another kind of hilarious thing later in the movie, because at a certain point I forgot that she was still alive and locked in the basement. With everything else that was going on, her reemergence was really funny to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have, to me, one of the most, I guess, iconic and disturbing scenes in the movie, where Pearl goes into the cabin while, I think at that point, just Maxine and the blonde, whose name I forget, are the only ones, I think, left in the cabin at that point.
Yeah, that's correct.
And Pearl has really fixated on Maxine in particular, thinks she's beautiful, thinks she has the X factor, as Maxine has been described as having a few different times in the film, and climbs into bed with her, undresses, I think, right? Doesn't Pearl get fully naked and gets into bed with Maxine, and then starts touching her with her blood-stained hands, which is fucking just bone chilling, spine tingling for me anyway. And then horrifying moment when Maxine wakes up and realizes who's actually sleeping next to her. Good stuff.
And it's,
oh my God, there's a shot earlier on that I'd forgotten about that was really great too, where Pearl is watching Maxine shoot a sex scene and imagines herself in Maxine's place, and we see. Do you remember that? That was creepy. Just a couple of seconds.
But, yeah. Yeah. Just Pearl creepily watching through the window while they shoot, and then weird smash cut to Pearl in Maxine's place, like riding the dude in the barn.
Ugh. Wearing the same makeup and everything.
Good stuff. Yeah. Good stuff.
And then we quickly transition from her in Maxine's bed to the show-stopping sequence of this film, which is she and her husband finally.
The alligator. The alligator kill comes first.
Okay, well, there's an alligator
kill. She feeds the fucking blonde girl to the alligator, and that's a delightful moment. She pushes her in the fucking water. And honestly, I think I had almost sort of forgotten briefly about the alligator. I don't know. It's a delightfully shocking moment, the way the alligator just comes flying out of the fucking water and eats this girl.
And yeah, and then you start to get a little bit more on board with like how you're supposed to be watching this movie, because nothing really outrageous has happened until that point, and like the kills have been pretty conventional. And I mean, like, I agree that the first kill with the stabbing is sensational, but it's pretty much what you expect in a slasher movie.
Then you're not gonna laugh at it. You're gonna cringe at it, not guffaw like you do when the alligator flies out of the water.
Exactly. You're not gonna guffaw. There's nothing like particularly creative about it. Same with the pitchfork stabbing. It's like we've seen that sort of thing before. But then every other kill in this movie, I have not seen something like that before.
Yeah, the Britney Still kill. Oh my god, that scene is so great leading up to it, with Pearl saying my favorite line in the film. Yeah. What have you ever done except be a whore?
Yeah.
And then she calls her a bitch, right?
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
After that, I just wrote bitch, and I was like, wait, which one of them said that?
I think they both do, because doesn't Britney Snow call her a bitch, and then Pearl pushes her in the water and says bitch after the alligator snatches her, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It's hilarious. Yeah. Suddenly we're in. I've got to look up interviews with Ty West. In the last act of this movie, we are not in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We are in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Mm. It goes full gonzo comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, if Dennis Hopper were alive, he would have played Pearl's husband. Mm-hmm. Also, I just blew my own mind. I'm pretty sure Mia Goth is supposed to be wearing the makeup that Leatherface wears in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the blue eyeshadow.
Interesting.
I believe that. Lipstick? Wow, that's, you just cracked the code. You just solved the Da Vinci code.
I can neither confirm nor deny, but that seems very intentional.
Yeah.
It's gotta be.
Prominent blue eyeshadow, yeah.
Especially when I was thinking, because when we see Pearl wearing the same makeup while she's envisioning herself in that sex scene, and she has kind of a leathery face, too. Sorry to say. Yeah.
But, Chris, tell us about the show-stopping scene. I just wanted to make sure we talked about the insane alligator moment before we got there.
Oh, yeah. Well, Pearl and her husband finally, after decades, perhaps, touch each other and love each other physically again. And it's I don't think it's supposed to be funny, but I laughed at the recurring thing where the, like, she's always coming on to the husband, and the husband's like, you know, my heart can't take it. Like, he keeps saying that. He's like, we've had this discussion before. My heart's too weak. My heart. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of a funny thing. And then so she finally comes on to him again. And this time he obliges, and they make love on the bed over Mia Goth, Maxine, who's listening and seeing the mattress sag over her head. And, you know, not something you see every day.
Not something you maybe ever want to see again.
And again, like, the issue isn't that they're old. The issue is that they are ghoulish. They're wearing ghoulishly old makeup. Yes. They look like you just found their bodies on a boat that's been at sea for weeks.
Well, and I think also because the killing and their sexual breakthrough seems to be precipitated by them having just gone on a killing spree is the other reason that it's upsetting.
Yes.
And also, I mean, just great visual of this, like, disgusting, horrifying, like, bed frame just sagging to an absurd amount, like, threatening to basically crush Mia Goth as they fuck on it. You know, it's just very well conceived.
Yeah, she's almost crushed by the weight of their love.
One of the things where I went, ooh, the most was when Jenna Ortega starts to break out of the basement and reaches her hand through to unlock the door and gets her hand shotgunned. Or does she get chopped? She gets smashed. With an axe, right? Or
I remembered it being something more like it seemed more like it was bludgeoned, I think. But I think it happens so fast that it's hard to tell what it's being bludgeoned with, but it's not really like severed, it's just her hand is kind of mangled in the process.
Yeah,
right?
I read it as an axe, but it could be any long-handled instrument.
An axe to chop down a part of the door to try to get out.
Yeah, but it was like that scene in Green Room that's so upsetting. Oh, like you put your arm through and then there's something that happens to it on the other side. Hate that.
But yeah, Maxine, it seems like maybe is starting to gain the upper hand. She gets a pistol from the truck, or no, the van that they all drove there in. And it seems like she and Jenna Ortega may be about to get away scot-free. And this is one of the shocking moments that maybe a little funnier, plays a little funnier than it should, but like Jenna Ortega is running away and just gets hit with like the world's most explosive shotgun blast. Like her legs just like fly out from under her.
Oh, it's fucking
and she
hilarious.
Collapses like a rag doll. It is hilarious.
It is hilarious because she and Mia Goth are having a fight basically, and she's like, "I'm sick of this. I don't want to go with you. I don't trust you.
Yeah.
I'm
you
going
got
this
me
way.
Into this. Yeah,
yeah. Right. I'm going. You go that way. I'm going this way." And she gets just taken out of the game very suddenly.
Yeah.
The only thing that's funnier, and I mean, when I saw this in the theater, the crowd cheered, screamed, when Pearl blows her own self away with the shotgun blast.
Damn. Yeah.
As she's firing the gun, and we just
see happens. Like, it's not the same like shotgun blast, to be clear.
No. But it's very soon after, and when she's in the doorway, and she just like flies away like a rag doll.
Yeah.
It's
yeah. That.
Oh my gosh.
There's some good shotgun foo in this for sure.
Yeah, the old couple have a couple of the most creative and hilarious deaths I've seen in a horror movie.
Yeah, because the husband's heart finally just gets out.
Chekhov's makes it through about his heart.
Yeah, he makes it through sex, and then what is it that finally shocks him?
He's dragging Jenna Ortega's body into the house.
Oh, she's too heavy.
And,
yeah,
and she's heavy, and he's
oh, that's right. She revives.
She just, like sputters, and it scares him, and he dies.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
So suddenly. And with, like, so little fanfare. There's no, like, grabbing his heart. He just kind of, like, collapses, gasps a little bit, and then his head slumps forward.
And, I mean, and it's also kind of sad, again. Like,
it is,
you know,
yeah.
Somehow you find yourself having sympathy for these horrible killers, even though they're horrible killers.
Yeah.
Because Pearl's, like, really distraught over this, as she should be.
Yeah.
Maxine holds up Pearl with her revolver, and I was like, you know what? I was like, please check the cylinder on this revolver. Please check it, because I knew, because they just had that discussion at the beginning of the movie. They have a discussion at the beginning of the movie where the old man's like, "Oh, I don't. That shotgun's not loaded. I just keep it to scare people off." And and Matthew McConaughey says, "Yeah, I have the same thing in my glove box," indicating to me that this gun might not be loaded.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so that's so smart. But also, I thought Matthew McConaughey was lying in that moment, like to try and
you've seen the gun by then, because when they see the barrel of the shotgun coming out of the house towards Matthew McConaughey, Maxine opens the glove box to see the revolver, because she's ready to go if this shit.
No, I mean, I thought he was lying about it being unloaded.
Oh, I see. Well, I figured there's a possibility. So, Maxine's
sure.
like that guy, the French guy in Taken, who can't tell the difference. She's been out of the game too long, so she can't tell the difference between a gun that's loaded and a gun that's empty, the weight in the hand. And so she tries to fire on Pearl to no avail. And it seems like Pearl's going to get the upper hand and blow her away with a shotgun, but she dodges it, and Pearl blows herself away.
Which, so what is that? What do they even call that? I think I keep wanting to say backfire, but that's a car. Recoil. What do you call that? Recoil. Kick. Yeah.
Yeah.
The gun like jams, right? I think we're.
No, it just it goes off, but the shotgun is somewhere fast. It.
Oh, like she's Pearl like a literally frail, like just a, can't handle the recoil of a shotgun. Oh, yeah. Okay, gotcha.
You should go on.
She's like a wisp of a waif. Like she weighs like 10 pounds, okay. So it just blows her away.
You gotcha. Should go on YouTube and watch like a compilation of people getting overcome with the recoil of guns they're shooting.
It's also, should I?
They don't die, but there's all these like pictures of like teenagers firing like a Desert Eagle, and the gun just like falls back and like smacks them in the nose and breaks their nose because they have so much kick and people don't know how to grip it and they're not expecting it to kick that much.
We'll put one in the show notes.
Yeah. But yeah, great
so,
shit.
Yeah. So I mean, and this is where we get to like the meat of the themes to me. The final interaction, the final showdown between these two. Where Pearl is like, you're nothing but a whore, you're the same as me, and there's, and notably, we have, we cut numerous times to this TV preacher yelling about,
Oh yeah, Father Coughlin, I wrote.
Yeah, that. Yeah, it's basically Father Coughlin.
It might as well
yeah,
be.
Yeah, yelling about like the perverts, the sex fiends, the murderers who inhabit America. We find out in the final moments of the movie that this TV preacher who we've seen many times is in fact Maxine's dad, who kind of holds her up as, you know, an example of how the youth of America are being perverted. And notably, when Pearl finally gets taken out by her own shotgun blast, he's yelling about divine intervention, which Maxine calls back to again, muttering about divine intervention to herself as she drives away from the scene of this whole thing. But I'm fascinated by how like both these women are sort of intoxicated by the like the power of beauty. Like they're both seeking to become beautiful stars, noted for their beauty, noted for their sexuality. Maxine wants to be a sex symbol. And we see how that's turned out for Pearl. Pearl points out the parallels between them, but there's no sense of solidarity. There's only a society that's used Pearl up and is presumably going to use Maxine up in the same way. And Maxine is perfectly willing to just like there's no recognition of any similarity there. She runs over fucking Pearl's head and then backs the truck up and does it all over again. Like she just gruesomely bashes Pearl's head in.
Her head explode, as Strong Bad would say.
As who?
As Strong Bad would say.
Who dat?
God, I haven't heard that in a long time.
we'll put the internet, link to Strong. Internet we'll culture. Put the link to Strong Bad in the show notes.
Yeah. And I don't know. There was just something very sad to me about this idea that I don't know, especially the idea that like divine intervention, like God has reached in to do away with like the quote unquote old whore, and both these women are forced by society into like feeling like they need to be. I keep using the term whore because they use it in the movie. Like that's what Pearl says a million times. She refers to herself yeah. and Maxine as whores. It's just really. There's a lot of pathos there to me. I don't know. I've rambled a lot there, but the connection between these women is very interesting. And to me, what the movie seems to be trying to say about them and how society treats women in general is very interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the fence. I mean, there's definitely stuff there, and it definitely invites you to think about these things. And of course, I always talk about how movies have themes and meanings, even if they don't intend them. There's something intended here, but I feel like it's a little bit half-baked, and it's there's sort of a skeleton here that they're just using to hang this exploitation film on. And we can think about it, but the movie isn't super developed along those lines. I don't know.
And I guess that's where I would go back to Pearl, because Pearl lends a lot more context to the character of Pearl. And so maybe I bring more to it because of that. But also I thought about these ideas a lot when I saw it the first time as well. I think Pearl fleshes it out some, but for me it was also there the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is kind of where I want to speculate about Maxine a little bit. So, like, Pearl, I mean, this is the most interesting franchise that has probably ever existed. Because it happened organically. There was no plan for there to be a trilogy of films. It was one film, and circumstances allowed for creative space to develop this idea further in both directions, a prequel and a sequel, all period pieces. Pearl did make me think about this film a little differently, though I still think Pearl is just fucking cuckoo bananas, and no matter what happened to her, there's no excuse for her behavior in this film. But it does make her a more compelling, interesting character. But I wonder if the same fate, the way that we see Pearl in Pearl compared to the way that we see her in X, I wonder if the events of X will affect Maxine in a similar way in the film Maxine XXX.
if this
is going to, because she's obviously the more sympathetic character, because yeah, maybe she's being exploited by society, but she feels fine with it, except for the fact that she has a coke problem on top of all of it. We haven't mentioned that she's doing lines through this whole fucking thing, which could also account for the fact that the film ratchets up its intensity and humor in the final act. I don't know.
You know what?
Perspective.
That's really interesting. Because, yeah, there is a really... Because she does coke, but like it makes sense given the scenes you see and everything. She does do coke at what I thought was a really weird moment to do coke, which is like right when all the murders happen.
The third act break.
And then, yeah.
Like right when the third act happens.
And
yeah.
From that point on, the movie does get more wild. So I kind of like that interpretation.
And we know that the next film is going to be set in the 80s, like the heyday of you know, cocaine and that kind of recreational drug abuse in Hollywood. And I have to wonder if she isn't going to turn into some kind, if she might not be sort of a monster.
Oh, in that, yeah.
Film, as opposed to a hero.
That would be my expectation.
Yeah, she no way.
Things are not going to end well for Maxine. Not that they even do in this film.
She's not...
She survives.
Well,
she
survives.
That's good enough for this film.
But she's like, I mean, and even more so, Maxine's definitely got a dark side.
You think? Yeah.
Yeah, she's got a dark side already. You can see it. She's hardly a... She's no angel. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Like, sure, she seems fine with, like, the path she's chosen. But, you know, again, I think she's choosing a path based on how society tells her she can succeed, which is through being beautiful and being a sex symbol. And, you know, we all know how society uses up its symbols of beauty and its sex symbols.
I think she talks about choosing the path and being happy with her life in the way that people who aren't really happy with their choices in their life talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think,
like, influencers.
Influencers. I'm thinking of the one season where I watched The Bachelorette, and a couple found real love. A man found real love with The Bachelorette, but he didn't want to marry her for a TV show, and so contractually she broke his heart and just married the other guy that she had no chemistry with so that she could get married on the show. Mm-hmm. And then they did the recap, the follow-up show, like, you know, that was 8 months ago, and now how are they doing today? And like, they were like, hey, like, you and that guy seem to really be in love, and then you just dumped him for bullshit reasons, like, how are you coping with that? And she was like, I'm living my best life. So I feel like that's how Maxine sort of talks about these things. She's it's like her mantra is like, I'm gonna get the life I deserve. But, you know, is she? Kind of a pretty hilarious reveal though with the preacher there, because the way he's like, let me tell you about my daughter, look at this face, and he like has a picture of her on an easel, and he like takes the fabric off. He's like, ah, she's been defiled.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, best thing I can say about this movie is I am curious to see Pearl and Maxine now.
Mm-hmm.
What a franchise, what a concept.
Yeah,
I remember back in the day you'd make Death Wish, and then Death Wish 2 would come out, and it was the same shit. And then Death Wish 3 would come out, and it would be the same
shit. Which is the best one. That's the best Death Wish.
Is that the one where he gets the gun in the mail, or is that Death Wish 4?
Death Wish 3 is the one where he goes after the punk scum, and he has, like, a fucking Gatling gun from his, like, buddy who was in Vietnam or something.
Jesus. No, but the final thing I'll throw in here about this franchise is, you know, so this started, this whole Death Wish fucking tangent started because you were saying, Chris, you know, like, you make Death Wish 2 and it's a carbon copy of Death Wish. And the delightful thing about X and Pearl is how they lean into the era of the film. And, like, you know, Ty West, a master of fucking, like, is pastiche the word I'm looking for?
Gimmick aesthetic.
Gimmick aesthetic. But he's so good at it. He's so good at, like, aping an era of filmmaking, and so this just leans into his strength so well. Like, all right, let's make a fucking late 70s slasher film. Let's make a fucking, like, Technicolor, like, golden age of cinema film. And then, you know, it seems we're going to make, like, kind of a late 80s video nasty with Maxine, and it's just, it's so delightful because each film feels so different. At least the two that have come out, and I'm presuming Maxine is going to be a whole different ballgame as well. So it's just perfectly suited to him. But anyways, that's X and Pearl. Steven, what are we watching next time?
This is a year of reflection for me, a year of but also of going back and looking at things that I have been on my queue for a long time that I just never got around to. You know, I'm a big Larry Cohen fan. We're going to watch 1974's It's Alive on our next episode.
It's about baby, right?
An ordinary couple's newborn baby turns out to be a fanged mutant who escapes from the delivery room and sets out on a grisly killing spree.
Yeah.
What more could you want? And it is exactly 90 minutes.
Sounds topical. Can't wait.
I still am, like, woefully undereducated on Larry Cohen, but the one Larry Cohen movie I saw, The Stuff, was a fucking banger, so I'm very excited.
The Stuff is a masterpiece. Weirdly, this is probably his, well, maybe not his most famous movie, but it's up there, but I have never seen it. And there are three of these. He made two sequels to it as well, so. Might have to get the box set if this one gets a view it.
Well, next episode, we'll be watching It's Alive. Until then, go to the socials, AMONcast, EHMONcast. Go to the Discord. Leave us a review. Go buy a t-shirt. Every horror movie on Netflix.com. And go watch fucking X. It got view-its from the three of us, which is a rare occasion. So, you know, do it. For every horror movie on Netflix, X. I'm Patrick.
Oof. I'm Chris.
I'm Stephen. Whoa.
Bye.